Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for coming. Subject this evening, 10 guaranteed steps to happiness. That is, the truth is, what we are trying to pursue in life, for many, many people, is happiness. You do a survey of people, ask, what is it that you want in life? I think a large amount of people will say, I'd like to be happy. And we know that happiness, of course, means that you are physically healthier. When you are happy, it means that you generally can get along with people better. When you are happy, it means that your marriage is better, your parenting is better, the relationships, etc. It has tremendous, tremendous impact. And it is our belief in Judaism that God wants us to be happy. And he is concerned with the fact that we should be happy. But the problem is that a lot of people are not. We simply have a lot of problems, and we don't seem to be very often able to overcome those problems and be happy. So, and what's the worst thing you can tell someone who doesn't appear happy? What's the worst thing you can actually say to someone?
It could be worse.
No, cheer up. But that does not work, right? That will either induce homicide or suicide or both, and in that order, homicide, that's it, right? I mean, I remember I was traveling a couple of years back, and it was, I did a Shabbat program, weekend program in West Palm Beach, Florida, and on Sunday afternoon, I was in the airport on the way back to New Jersey. I got a phone call. Someone said, look, we had a person, a rabbi, who was going to give a tour of Prague, and he got bronchitis. Could you do a tour of Prague for this group? I said, yeah, I think I can do that. And I said, when are you leaving? I figured, yeah, they'll tell me a couple of months, etc. He says, tomorrow afternoon. I said, you mean Monday? He said, yeah. So now I had to rethink because I'd never actually been to Prague before. But I figured if I had a few months, no big deal, right? So now I had a few hours. Okay, so I stayed up all night, studied about Prague, and I went to Prague the next day and did the tour, 2 days, 3 days in Prague, came back, and then on Sunday, I went to Cleveland to speak, then followed by Columbus, and then followed by Chicago. So Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Cleveland, Columbus, Chicago. In Chicago, after my speech, I get a phone call from Australia that my mother had to have an operation, and I needed to get to Australia ASAP. So that was Wednesday lunchtime. I flew back from Chicago to Newark Airport, went to my house about 25 minutes from Newark Airport, packed for Australia, and got a flight to San Francisco, missed the connecting flight to Australia, and stayed in San Francisco 24 hours, and eventually got to Australia Friday morning. My mother's operation was Thursday, thank God she was fine. Got there after the operation, right? Sunday, my father broke his hip, nothing to do with my presence, it just happened, right? And I was there, but thank God I was there for about a week and a half. My family, my sister lives there, etc. But it's good that I was there, able to take care of my father, help him out, my mother, visit at the hospital, etc., etc. And then after about a week and a half, I was eventually going back home to New Jersey, and I got the flight to Sydney. The flight to San Francisco got cancelled. So I got a flight to Los Angeles. Eventually, Los Angeles said, okay, I need to get back home. I need to get back home to see my wife. What's her name? Whatever. You know, it was unbelievable. At that point, I was so discombobulated. I was so jet-lagged. I had so sick of traveling. You cannot imagine how sick I was of traveling at that point. The hours I spent in the airplane. And then they finally got me a flight, but it was via Washington, D.C. I said, okay, you know, fine, Washington. So I'm at the very last stop. I'm in Washington, D.C., about to board the plane. And they pull me aside for the random security check. Now, because obviously I look suspicious. So the random security check. So, you know, I looked at this guy I thought he was going to press the emergency button. Just the look I gave him was, he could have died from it. Anyway, and I looked it was really upset. And he did the check, and he looks at me and he says, you don't look too happy. He says, why don't you cheer up, man? You know, had I had a 3.5-ounce bottle of liquid on me, he would have been dead. I mean, that's it, right? So thank God they'd taken it away, so everything was fine. But again, right, selling something to cheer up is not going to do it. So how do we achieve happiness, something which we really do want to achieve? So let me start with a bizarre Hasidic story about a Hasidic Rebbe who is quite an interesting Hasidic Rebbe, very, very unique, the Reb Simcha Bunim of Pershischa. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, Pershischa. It's a town in Poland which consists of all consonants and no vowels and a number of Z's and C's and stuff like that. So, but in any case, Reb Simcha Bunim of Pershischa was a unique person. He was a CEO of a lumber plant in Danzig before he was a rabbi. Eventually, he decided he wanted to move to a more Hasidic area of Poland. So he got a degree in pharmacology in Warsaw and got and started practicing. He set up a pharmacy business, and he actually became the supplier of pharmaceuticals to Napoleon's army in Poland. Very successful. And then he went blind, so he could not practice in his pharmacy business anymore, and he became a Hasidic Rebbe. This is a very interesting, unique guy. So, but even when he was the CEO of the lumber plant, he had students, he had people who would come to him for advice, he would teach Torah to people. Quite an amazing man. He was known as someone who had an excellent sense of humor, who never ever smiled. So he is walking along the banks of a river in Danzig with a couple of his students. And it was a stormy night, there was a very strong wind blowing, and the path was quite muddy and slippery. And as they're walking along, the wind blew one of the students off balance, and he slips in the mud into the river. And he couldn't swim, and the Rebbe couldn't swim. And I mean, not, I think any of them were able to swim. And the river was a raging torrent, and it was very windy, and this guy is thrashing around in the river. And Reb Simcha Bunim Pershischa looks at him and he says to him, in Yiddish, I'll translate, he says, "Give a grus to Leviathan," which means when you get down there, give regards to the Leviathan. The Leviathan is the mythical, legendary sea creature living in the depths of the ocean. And the Rebbe, right, says to the drowning guy, "Listen, when you get down there, regards to the Leviathan." Now, this is not very helpful. Is it? I mean, it's not, you know, not the type of thing they teach you in lifeguarding school. I mean, like, you know, so. But what happened after the Rebbe said this, what happened was, this guy, something changed in his demeanor, and the guy in the river starts, you know, thrashing towards, and he actually makes it to the shore, and he's able to drag himself out. So he has survived, you know, despite the Rebbe's so-called help. So the other student said, "What was going through your mind? What are you thinking of when you say this to him? What are you thinking of?" So the Rebbe said, "I'll tell you what. You know, the verse says in Isaiah, 'Ki besimcha teitzeu,' which means you shall go forth in joy." He said, "But I looked at it, I interpreted it differently. With simcha, with happiness, teitzeu, you can get out of anything." And he said, "I figured to myself, I saw this guy's face, he was full of despair. He had totally given up and lost hope." He says, "I figured if I tell him something which will bring even the slightest amount of happiness to his mind," it's a joke, I mean, you know, it was a joke, "and even that," he says, "that will have an impact on him, and hopefully it will change his demeanor, and he'll use the last ounce of his strength to get out of the river," and that's actually what happened. So that's the story. It's a little bit of a strange story, but I think it is telling us a very, very beautiful idea, which is that very often we are in situations which appear hopeless, we're in situations which appear terrible, and we're in situations where we despair. And very often, the truth is, we could get out of the problem, we could get out of the situation if we did not despair, if we did not give up hope. And very often, the greatest enemy and the greatest danger in situations is nothing external, but it is rather the internal. It is the internal attitude of the person, which is probably the greatest factor in success in every area of life, the greatest factor in happiness, and the greatest factor in getting out of despair. So I'd like to discuss 10 steps, 10 things that people can do. You don't have to do all 10, but there are 10 things, and some of them, all of them rather, we find in Talmudic literature, in Jewish literature, but it's interesting to note, all of them we find empirical evidence that they work from the schools of positive psychology. You're probably all aware, psychology, since it started, has been studying, who have psychologists primarily been studying on the whole? Anyone? No, but what type of people do psychologists study? Yeah, crazy people. Well, yeah, basically, that's not the technical term, you're right, but psychologists have been studying people who have problems. So now, there's a fellow called Seligman, and Martin Seligman said to himself, you know, if we want to teach people how to be happy, we don't teach people how to be happy, whom should we be studying? People who are happy or people who are depressed? People who are happy or people who have problems? Right, in fact, imagine, you want to learn how to play golf. What do you do? Go to a mini golf course and watch fifth graders whack the ball around? What you want to do is watch Tiger Woods. I'm talking about happiness. I'm talking about golf. He's a good golfer, right? So you can, you know, you watch him. That's how you learn golf. So they said, the basic idea they said was, well, if we want to study how to get people to be happy, then we should be studying people who are apparently happy. So there's a whole school called positive psychology, based on the work of Martin Seligman, Tal Ben-Shachar at Harvard University, and Sonia Lyubomirsky California, I forgot which university, UCLA, I believe it is. And they've done a tremendous amount of empirical research in happiness studies. So it is wonderful to see things that my mother told me, my grandmother told me, things that I saw in the Talmud, things that we intuitively feel are correct, but it's great to see empirical studies that show that these things actually work. So let's start with the first. The first and the easiest and probably the most effective method of gaining happiness is something very, very simple. And they are all simple. All of these things are simple. But sometimes because they're so simple, we figure, it's ridiculous. But it is very simple and it's very easy to do. It is expressing gratitude. Expressing appreciation and expressing gratitude and doing it regularly. When you do this, guaranteed. In fact, they had a study of a group of women with MS, multiple sclerosis, and they divided them into various groups, and one group just had their regular, whatever treatment they were taking, the medication, etc. Another group was involved, they, in addition to that, they would log onto a website once a week, and they would put into the website, they'd think about it, and they'd type in three things about which they were grateful that happened in the past week. They could be very minor things. The sun came up one day in New Jersey. We're happy about that. Right? So, minor things. Right? In New York, someone let me merge. Right? That is a very major significance. That's keep in mind. Right? So there are things like that. So, but again, three things about which they appreciated. And they showed a remarkable increase in both their, not surprisingly, in their psychological state of being, but even in their physical well-being. Gratitude. And how does it work? It works in a number of ways. Number one, it promotes the enjoyment of life. The more you appreciate what you have, the more you appreciate what you are partaking of, the more you appreciate the activity, the more you appreciate the friendship, then obviously the more you will enjoy it. If you take something, some food, and just scarf it down, etc., right, on your way out, just stuff it down your mouth, that's not an enjoyable situation. You're not going to enjoy it as much as if you really appreciate it, you look at it for a while, you smell it for a while, etc. So A, it just gives you a greater level of enjoyment, which obviously is going to make you happier. B, it bolsters self-worth and self-esteem, because you see that you have these things, you see all these wonderful relationships, you see a wonderful child, you see a wonderful parent, you see a wonderful sibling, etc., etc., you see you have a house, and so on and so forth. Appreciate it gives you a sense of self-esteem. It helps you cope with stress and trauma. The more you appreciate the positive things, the greater your ability to cope with stress and with trauma in amazing ways. One of my sons is currently in the Israeli army. My oldest son finished the army, but my second son is now in the Israeli army. And I visited Israel, and he got off during the time I was in Israel, 5 days. And I invited him. I said, stay with me at the hotel where I'll be. And he said, oh, fantastic, absolutely fantastic. I said, it's not a greatest hotel. I said, the room's a little small. He said, Abba. He said, room? You have a room? He says, I've been sleeping in a tent for the past month in the Negev Desert. He says, you're offering me a room and you're telling me it's a small room? Are you kidding me? So the fact is, how many of us appreciate having a room? An actual room. He appreciated it. And his enjoyment, here I am complaining that it's not such a great hotel. Did I enjoy the experience of the hotel? Not a lot. Right? But when my son came, it was a whole new attitude. So it's a tremendous, tremendous help. It also, I should point out, when you appreciate what you have, it encourages moral behaviour. Who's more likely to help someone else? Someone who appreciates what they have or someone who feels they've been shortchanged? Fairly obvious, right? The person who feels they've been shortchanged in life is much less likely to help someone else. The person who feels that they have sufficient, that they appreciate what they have, much more likely to engage in moral behaviour. In addition, it helps build social bonds and strengthens relationships. If I feel and I appreciate what I have, I'm more able to share with people. For example, I just came on the plane this afternoon, and as you're all aware, the technology in a modern day passenger jet is absolutely incredible. It's amazing. Right, can fly at speeds of approximately 500 to 600 miles per hour. I think now they do 500 miles per hour to reduce fuel costs or whatever. But let's say it can go 500 miles per hour, can carry a few hundred people, 500 miles per hour, can travel. It can fly for 16 hours. I know I've done it, Los Angeles to Melbourne. Right, can fly continuously 16 hours, 400 people, 500 miles per hour. Unbelievable technology. And with all that incredible technology, they cannot design an armrest that two people can use comfortably. It is beyond imagination. I mean, they've got geniuses who design something that weighs hundreds of tons, that can go 30,000 feet in the air for 16 hours at 500 miles per hour, and the armrest, there's only one sweet spot on the armrest. And if you have it, you will never move your elbow. I'm telling you, Los Angeles to Melbourne, 16 hours, my elbow's there. I had to get something in the overhead compartment, elbow's there. Right? It's unbelievable. Because you know, if you move your elbow, the other person's elbow's going to get into that space. That's it. It's over. You'll have a cramp for the rest of the flight. And you see, the reason for that is, if I don't feel I have enough armrest for myself, I cannot share it with the other person. If I am happy and content with whatever armrest I have, which is zero, let's say, but let's say I'm happy and content with it, I'm able to share with someone. So another aspect of appreciation is the fact that I'm able to better share with other people, and that means I'm able to have better relationships. I'm a less mean person. So tremendous. Gratitude also, generally we find, is incompatible with negative emotions. It diminishes anger. It diminishes bitterness, it diminishes greed. And most importantly, and this is one of the great problems that we have, especially with being happy, is what's called hedonic adaptation. Hedonic adaptation, let's say it's freezing cold outside, and you walk into the warm house, how do you feel? Fantastic. How long do you feel fantastic for? A few minutes. So after about 2 minutes, you say, oh, I feel great, and then after a few minutes, it's getting a little warmer here. Then after about 10 minutes, honey, what do you think? Gas is free? Turn down the thermostat. Hedonic adaptation means that we become used to certain pleasures, and the more used to them we become, the less we enjoy them. Hedonic adaptation happens in many areas of life. Right? If you live in a beautiful area, you live in a place with a great climate, you don't appreciate that until you go somewhere with a lousy climate. You live in a place where you have nice clean water, you don't appreciate it until you go to a place where you don't have water. So very often, it takes losing something in order to actually appreciate it. But it doesn't have to be that way. We can actually do exercises to appreciate things. That was one of them. In Jewish tradition, we say a blessing before we eat. I was in Charlotte. On the way back, last time I was in Atlanta, on the way back from Atlanta, I stopped in Charlotte at the airport. I'm going to be stopping there Tuesday as well. Small coffee shop there. I have my coffee, I pick it up, I say a blessing, Baruch Atah, right? Eat it. This woman next to me, she says, excuse me? I said, no, I didn't say anything to you. She said, do you always talk to your food before you eat it? Madam, I was not talking to the food. But I said I was saying thank you for it. I was appreciating the fact that I have a coffee. right? And you know what? When you do express the appreciation, you actually enjoy it more. You actually enjoy it more. When you express appreciation, and in Judaism, we have an amazing array of blessings. Spring is coming soon. Spring is coming soon. In springtime, Jewish tradition tells us that when you see a fruit tree budding for the first time in the month in which Passover falls, Pesach, Nisan, the month of Nisan, with the first fruit tree you see with buds on it, you say a blessing. Blessed are God, King of the universe, who has created beautiful creatures and a wonderful world for the pleasure and the benefit of humanity. It's a great thing. How many of us appreciate, first of all, we're Jews, so how many of us know what a fruit tree looks like? Right? But again, right, but when we see it, right, and we make that blessing, it's a sign, it's appreciation. And it actually makes you happier. It's great exercise to every now and again to appreciate your spouse or your children. Right? Not just once a year at the anniversary. Right? Not just once a year. I have a friend, he brought flowers. He lives in Israel. His wife's Israeli. His children are Israeli. He's American. He's from Oklahoma. He speaks Hebrew, obviously. His wife's Israeli. Right? But they speak only Hebrew at home. And his kids' English is not bad. His Hebrew is fine. But he sometimes searches for certain words. So he comes home for the anniversary with a bouquet of flowers. First time. He decided, you know, it was there. I don't know what it was. But usually he got something else. He decided to get flowers. So the kids are out playing outside. They say, Abba Maze. Right, what's with the flowers? They said, Dad, what's with the flowers? He said, so he couldn't think of the Hebrew word for anniversary. So he says, the same day in the year that your mother and I got married many, many years ago, right, this is the same day in the year that happened. So the kid says, Hayortzeit shel hachatuna. The yortzeit of the wedding. Right? Explain it to your friends afterwards who do not know Yiddish. But the appreciation is something which is important. It's important to express it to the other person, but I'm not talking about expressing it to the other person. That's important in relationships. To express your appreciation is very important in relationships. But it's not just that. It is expressing it to yourself so you can actually understand what we actually have. And unfortunately, tragically, today, all you have to do is read the newspaper or listen to the news and you can immediately start appreciating the things that we have. A friend of mine, you know, one of the blessings we say in the morning, the whole list of blessings, one of the blessings we say is, blessed are God who's roka haaretz al hamayim, who has spread the earth out over the water, who has given me solid land on which to live. So a friend of mine who was on vacation in Thailand a number of years ago said he never really appreciated that blessing until the tsunami. Thank God he survived, but to appreciate the fact that we have dry land for habitation, he says, is not something that we often appreciate. Right? It's not a bad idea. Last summer, I went on a 5-day hike in the Canadian Rockies with some friends, one of my kids, and some friends and their kids. And you have to carry everything with you, including your tent. You have to carry all the cooking fuel. You have to carry all the garbage out of the national park, and so on and so forth. You have to do all types of stuff, which, you know, filter water. And you know, you begin to really, when you get back to civilization. We got back to a hotel and had a shower. My son comes out of the shower. Normally, as a kid, I have to like threaten him with all types of stuff, so he actually has a shower. And I have to yell through, like, are you using shampoo? He says, yeah, whatever. This time he comes out of the shower, he says, Abba, this was the best shower I ever had in my entire life. Because for 5 days we're hiking in the wilderness, right? The water's too cold to walk. I mean, it's unbelievable. So you begin to appreciate things. So that is number one. I know it sounds type of obvious, maybe even a little hokey, right? But it's a very, very simple thing. To set aside a little time once a week. Maybe you could try it once, twice a week, but at least once a week. Appreciate things you have. Write down, talk about it, say it. 3 things, 4 things that you appreciate in your life, and it will guaranteed make you happier. Number two, very important, acts of kindness. The more acts of kindness that a person does, the happier that person will be. Again, in one of the studies conducted by Sonia Lyubomirsky, they had 3 groups of people with a serious disease, I don't remember what it was. I believe it was cancer. They had one group with just their regular medication and the normal treatment they'd be receiving medically. A second group had people, volunteers, interacting with them socially on a regular basis, taking them out, going to movies with them, just playing chess with them, etc., etc. And the third group were the people who were doing that social interaction. Is it clear? So one group, nothing, regular medication. Second group, people giving to them, people helping them out, people interacting with them. And the third group are the people who are doing the giving. I think you can probably guess which group showed the greatest increase in happiness and the greatest increase even in their physical well-being was not group number two. It was the third group I mentioned, the ones who were giving. The ones who received good from people, they definitely showed improvement. The more social interaction, the more joy in their lives, the better they were. However, the group that benefited the most were the group who were actually doing the voluntary giving. The group who were doing the kindness, the group who were giving, they were the ones who benefited the most. Why is this so? How does it work? Why is it that when you give, you benefit the most? First of all, if you give to other people, you perceive them in a more kindly manner. The more you give to another person, the better you look at them. When I give to a child, when a mother, when a father gives to their child, their young child, it actually increases their love for that child. The more they give, the more they love the child. You have situations, there was a famous Rabbi Dessler who was separated from his family during the Second World War. He got a visa to England. His wife and children got a visa to Australia. They were living in Lithuania. They grabbed whatever visas they could because they wanted to get out of there. And he was separated from his wife and daughter. He actually didn't even hear from them. He didn't even know they were alive. And he was in England. After the war, they were reunited. He said, clearly, his wife, who had their infant daughter and brought her up during the war, had a much closer relationship with the daughter than he did, clearly. But he tried to think about what is the mechanism, why is it so? And his conclusion was because his wife, the mother, had given so much more to this child. She invested so much of herself in that child that she and the child were intrinsically closer because there was more of her, so to speak, in the child, more of the child in her. So when you give, you actually become more kindly disposed towards people. Secondly, it heightens the awareness of community and it heightens the awareness of your interdependence upon others and their interdependence upon you, and that makes you happier. When you feel you're part of a community, it gives you a sense of happiness. Gives you a sense of joy. I had the misfortune about a year ago, last winter, someone gave me 4 free tickets to an American football game. So I felt that I had to go, and I took 3 of my boys with me. I have no interest whatsoever in American football. So I took 3 of my boys with me. It was at the Giants Stadium in New Jersey, and it was the New York Jets versus the Denver Horses or Knights or whatever. Yes, Broncos, whatever. The Denver Ponies. Right. And so it's the New York Jets and the Denver Ponies. And anyway, so we had seats in the section where the families of the football players sat at the 50-yard line undercover. I understand these are good seats. So we went there. We had to park in a parking lot that looked like something. It looked like a parking lot in Beirut, and it was like a war torn area of New Jersey. We got a bus that looked like something out of the United Nations Relief and Welfare Organization that took us to the actual stadium. And then we get into the stadium. We're sitting on uncomfortable seats. It was freezing cold. It was unbelievably cold. I'm surrounded by Neanderthals, Cro-Magnons. It was unbelievable, right? And again, freezing, damp, etc. And, you know, the bathrooms, there was a half-hour wait to get to the bathroom. You had to have a biohazard suit to get in there. It was unbelievable, right? And out of the 4 hours we're actually at the stadium, only 1 hour was the actual game. And of the 1 hour of the actual game, they're only actually moving with speed for approximately 25 minutes of it. The rest of the time is committee meetings. It is unbelievable. I thought, you know, in Australia, we do that before the game. The game, you just play the whole time, right? Anyway, so, and every time anything exciting happened, which was rarely, everyone in front of me would stand up, so I can't see anything. And it was a horrible experience. I took out a book. My kids said, don't take out a book. You'll you'll get beaten up. It's whatever, you know. It's like they don't like people who can read these games. Anyway, so every now and again, people stand up and do a cheer, J-E-T-S, Jets, Jets, Jets. And I looked around and I said, thank God the name is not more than four letters long, because they'd have whatever. Anyway, so but I asked people, friends of mine who actually go to the football, I said, even if I could imagine that you'd actually enjoy watching American football, let's say, right? I said, why would you actually go to a game? Sit at home on a comfortable couch with beer of your own choice, with people next to you of your own choice, clean bathroom, no one standing up in front of you, right? You can watch on a high definition, right? You know, large screen television with fantastic sound. You can see it better from your couch at home than you can at the football game. Why on earth would, and people actually pay to go to it. Use the home for free. So you know what most people told me? They told me that the reason they go is the experience of being with 50,000 other people screaming their heads off at the Jets and the Ponies, the Broncos, whatever. Right? So really, what was their what were they enjoying? Was it the football per se? I think it was much more the experience of being part of something much bigger than themselves. Part of the crowd, part of the group. There's a tremendous, tremendous joy that we have, because human beings are seekers of unity. We are seekers of community. We are seekers of relationships. The more you give, the greater your feeling of relationship, the greater your interconnection to the community, and therefore, the greater the fulfillment of that need and that desire of the human being, and therefore, obviously, the greater your happiness. It encourages appreciation of your own good fortune. If you give to someone who needs, you now have an appreciation for your own good fortune. It alleviates feelings of guilt, which also makes you happier. It has a positive impact on your self-image, because you now perceive yourself as a good person. So these are not altruistic. I'm not talking about altruism here. Of course altruism is wonderful. Of course a person should give because they feel it's the right thing to do. But forget that for the moment. I'm not talking about altruism. Better that you should give for selfish reasons than not give. But these reasons are authentic reasons. Nothing wrong with it. It's okay to be concerned about your own happiness. And if my own happiness is increased by giving to someone else, what's wrong with that? Fantastic. So these are selfish reasons, but that's how it is. And also I should point out, the last point is that giving jumpstarts a whole cascade of social interaction. When you give to someone, you invite someone to your home, you give someone chat, whatever it happens to be, this can actually jumpstart a whole social interaction, and social interactions, and these type of relationships are actually also happiness creators and enhancers. That is number two, and of course, our sages tell us that this is the idea that when a person gives, the one who's giving receives much more than the one who's receiving. And that is something which we know. If someone asks you for a loan, is it easier to ask for a loan or to give a loan? Not financially. I'm talking about psychologically. It's easier to give a loan. When I ask for a loan, what am I saying? I was not successful. I am incapable of taking... I don't have enough money, etc. Please give me a loan. When you give the loan, what are you saying about yourself? I'm successful. I'm generous. I'm trusting. Right? I am someone who is going to help. That's a great thing for your self-esteem. It's a good thing. Psychologically, giving is much better than taking. And so, therefore, the second... Oh, we're up to... I forgot what we're up to. Right? The second strategy is acts of kindness. Very, very central. Very, very important. And it's guaranteed. Guaranteed. To increase your feeling of happiness. Guaranteed. Social relationships. The Torah tells us, love your neighbour as yourself. The idea of loving other people, very hard to do. It's not so easy to love everyone. Right, and I'll give you some names of people who's very difficult to love. But basically, it's not so easy to love people. But nevertheless, there are things that we can do. The Torah dictates to us that we should act in a way that we love other people. We should act towards them with love. But when we do increase that type of love, and there are things you can do that actually help you love other people better. Right? In fact, some of the things I already mentioned, appreciation of what you have makes you more open to liking other people. Appreciation of your relationships itself, a better self-image helps you love other people more. The more you give to other people helps you love them more. But again, loving other people, of course, since we are created as social creatures, God created us not to be alone. It says in the Torah, Lo tov heyot ha'adam levado. It's not good for the person to be alone. We're not supposed to be loners. And you know what? In Jewish tradition, there's a fascinating statement Maimonides makes. Maimonides says that a Jew who observes Jewish law, 100%, strictly kosher in everything, right? Shabbat, every aspect of Jewish law, he observes it. Doesn't do any sins. But he isolates himself from the community. He does not celebrate when the community celebrates. He does not mourn when the community mourns. Such a person has the status of someone who has abandoned his religion and taken on another religion. In other words, here's a guy. You look at this guy and he looks totally, oh my gosh, he looks like a tzaddik. Totally righteous. But yet, because he has isolated himself, disconnected himself from the community, he is considered to be like an apostate. It's as though he has taken on Islam, for example. It's as though he's become a Hindu, Buddhist, whatever. Right? He has abandoned Judaism. Why? What's the Because we believe that Judaism is something you cannot do by yourself. You've got to be part of a community. You've got to be connected to community. And that is essential to the human condition. It's essential to the fulfillment of your soul to be part of a community, connected to community. So love of your fellow human being, love of your fellow Jew, love of other people is something which is essential to the fulfillment of who we are as people. And also it means, by the way, a healthy love relationship, there is much less hedonic adaptation. Because in relationships there can also be hedonic adaptation. People become bored with other people. There are magazines whose entire purpose is to follow the couplings and uncouplings of Hollywood celebrities. Okay, but basically, you know, the amount of celebrities in Hollywood who actually have stable marriages that have lasted with one person, that have lasted for more than, let's say, 5 years. How many of them are there? Probably count them on the fingers of one hand, right? There's not a heck of a lot. And you think about it and you say to yourself, I don't understand it. Right, here's there some person like, let's say, Nicole Kidman. Gorgeous, Australian, intelligent, what more could you want? Right? Half the men in the world would love to have a relationship with her. And you have someone, let's say, like Hugh Jackman, right? Handsome, intelligent, Australian, right? Reminds me of myself. Let's say, so you have, and so now, so you have two people like that, who, like half the males in the world, would love to have a relationship with this woman. Half the women in the world would love to have a relationship with this man. And yet, when people of that type have a relationship with each other, how long does it last? In some cases, less than a day. In some cases, a month, a year, right? That's it. It's over, right? Until they meet in rehab, they get married, and then what happens is they're divorced in a few months. Why is that so? The answer is, if all you want is to get for yourself, if you're an egomaniac, then there is hedonic adaptation, meaning even though you become adapted to this as well, you take Nicole or Hugh for granted. That's what happens. Even so, when there's a love relationship, and love means the desire to give, that is not satiated. That there is no hedonic adaptation, that you do not become bored with. The desire to give is a different type of relationship. And that is very, very essential to the love of your neighbour as yourself, basically is fulfilled by this by giving. And by giving, that creates healthy relationships. Again, less hedonic adaptation, less boredom, and therefore greater happiness. Another important one, forgiveness. Being able and willing to forgive people is one of the most important components of a happy life. If you go through life bearing a grudge, bearing a hatred, right? That person, what are you kidding? 5 years ago, there's a friend of mine, a rabbi in England, he suggested to a certain family, he says, there's a girl, wonderful girl I know, also of the German Jewish tradition, this family that we call Yekkers, German Jews. So he said, he had this girl from a German Jewish family, and he says to this other German Jewish family who has a son of appropriate age, he says, I think this girl will be a wonderful match for your son. They said, what is the family name? And he said the family name. They said, no. He said, why not? You don't even know the person. He says, that family in the Frankfurt on Main ghetto fire, their family did not give lodging to our family after the house burnt down. So my friend the rabbi said, but the Frankfurt on Main ghetto fire was in 1920. They said, oh no, we're not referring to that one. We're referring to the first one in 1750. How happy can a person be if they can never forgive? If every slight that they experience, right, is something which stays within them and burns? Right? If someone, I mean, it's unbelievable. So forgiveness, very important. As it says, verse says in Kohelet, it says this, Haser ka'as melibcha, if you remove anger from your heart, ha'aver ra'ah mibsarecha, you'll remove evil from your flesh. If you take away anger from your heart, then your very flesh, your physical well-being, will become better. Certainly you're psychological, and it works in many ways. Clinging to bitterness and hatred harms you much more than the other person. My hatred for that person, does that hurt the other person? You know, when you glare at the person and you look at them with the hatred, right? Does that hurt them? They're walking along, they're having a great time, and I'm standing there, right? What do I think? That I'm burning a hole in them? They don't even know I'm looking at them. They're having a fantastic time. Who's being hurt by the hatred? I am. That's number one. Number two, right, you're more likely to be happier, healthier, serene and agreeable if you're not harbouring horrific hatred for someone. Obvious, I know it's type of obvious, isn't it? Right, I mean, a person who's walking around with just this hatred in them, they're not serene, they're not easy to get along with, they're unpleasant. By the way, also, harbouring hostility and hatred for people, that means within you, that tends towards depression, hostility, anxiety, anger, neuroses, right? You can get rid of all these things. Forgiveness. You are better able to empathize with others if you're a forgiving person. If you're not a forgiving person, very hard to empathize with other people. You're better able to maintain a relationship if you can forgive. This is type of obvious. If, you know, people make mistakes in relationships all the time. People say the wrong thing. Has anyone here not ever said the wrong thing? Mark Twain once said, we always regret what we say much more than what we don't say. Right? Keeping your mouth shut is usually safer. Usually much safer. But we always have said the wrong thing. If the person I said the wrong thing to is not able to forgive me, how can we have a relationship? I remember I was a rabbi in Toronto for 4 years. And our office got a new phone system. And you know those new phone systems where you have no idea how to work it. And so someone had left. I got a whole bunch of voicemail messages, and I'm going through them, writing them down on post-it notes, etc. Pressing save and delete. Has anyone ever pressed delete by accident instead of save? Ever happened to anyone?
Yeah.
Okay, I delete the message. So anyway, but I had so many messages because the phones were out for a while. So many messages, I forgot that I deleted the message, and I forgot about the message. Okay, so I answered the other messages. I walk into my shul, my synagogue, that's Shabbat, and I notice there's a guy who's always there, was not there. Okay, sometimes people don't turn up. Okay, so the next week, he's not there. Second week, he's not there. This guy has been coming for 2 years, every single week, not there the second week. So immediately, I figure maybe he's not well, because it wasn't vacation time, so I phoned him. I get the voicemail, I leave a message, Rabbi Becher here, please call me back, I'm just wondering if everything's okay. He doesn't call back. I leave a voicemail on his cell phone, doesn't call back. I call again at home, I eventually get through to him. He says, look, I really do not want to talk to you, Rabbi, at the moment. Sorry, click. I said, what is wrong here? So I'm persistent. So I phoned him again. And he says, listen, Rabbi, please don't call. I said, what did I do? He says, I phoned you 3 weeks ago about an extremely important matter in my life, and I wanted your advice. And you never called me back. You didn't call me back. He says, I was hurt. He says, I can't get over this. I said, do you know that we just got a new phone system in the synagogue? He said, yeah. I said, are you aware that you left a message about a day after I got that new phone system? He said, yeah. I said, you know, is it possible, you ever thought that maybe I deleted it by accident and then forgot? Is it possible that would happen? He said, yeah. I said, well, so 2 years of our relationship and the whole thing is over because of one mistake. I mean, how many people make mistakes? If you would judge a person only by their mistakes, Right? I mean, it would be disastrous. Disastrous. You'd never have a relationship with anyone. So forgiveness is central to happiness. Central. We have to be able to forgive. There's a prayer which in Jewish tradition we say every single night. Beautiful prayer. Every single night before you go to bed. You know what the prayer is? We say this. Hareini mochel. I forgive anyone who angered me. Anyone who called me shehichnis, vehichnis, vehichnitoti, anyone who angered me, anyone who insulted me. I forgive everyone. Every night before we go to sleep, we say Shema, but before we say Shema, before we say, Hear, O Israel, Lord, God, Lord, one, you know what we're supposed to say? I forgive everyone who angered me. Now, even if you don't really feel it sincerely, it's a good idea to do it anyway. Forgiveness will make you happier, guaranteed. And I should also point out, it allows you to move on in life instead of being stuck, right? 10 years ago in the ghetto, fire in Frankfurt on Main in 1720, and in 1990, you're still stuck there. Move on. Move on. Get over it, as people say, right? Get over it. That is a very central idea. Forgiveness. Forgiveness. Central, and it works. Next, flow experience. A flow. This is a term coined by a psychologist whose name I cannot pronounce. But basically, what it means is this. That when you're involved in an activity, try to focus completely on that activity. The more activities of the sort in which you are totally involved, mind, body and soul, in that activity, the happier you'll be. Anyone think of that? Everyone had an experience like that? You do an activity and you are just you become totally involved in the activity. It could be something very simple. It could be baking. It could be cycling. It could be going on the treadmill. It could be taking care of a child. It could be playing chess. Right? Whatever the activity is, the greater this activity is a flow activity, meaning that I'm in the flow, I'm totally involved in it, that type of activity, the more of those type of activities you will do, the happier you will be for a number of reasons. A, it makes it a more inherently and pleasurable experience. If I'm in a flow experience, you know, think of it, right? When you talk to your child, schmooze with your son, your daughter, okay? And while you're doing this, so they're telling you about the school, the carnival today. It's like, yeah, and, oh, really? Sorry. And what happened then, right? How enjoyable is that? First of all, how enjoyable is that for the child? It's horrific. It's child abuse, right? I don't belittle child abuse, but it's emotional abuse, right? And how enjoyable is it for you? On the other hand, you are totally focused on the kid, and the kid's telling you the joy they had at the Purim carnival today. Is that a fun experience? Of course it is. And the more you are focused on that experience, the more it envelops you, and the more you're involved in it and put your whole self into it, of course the happier you will be. It's unbelievable. So number one, it makes the experience more enjoyable. Number two, since it's a rewarding experience, it'll make you want to repeat the experience. And if the experience is pleasurable, and you now are motivated to repeat a pleasurable experience, that means it's going to make you happier. It leads you to greater involvement in life. Depression very often leads to a person withdrawing from aspects of life, withdrawing from activities, withdrawing from life. The more I'm involved in a flow activity, if when I'm praying I'm really focused on the prayers, it's a different experience. Instead of thinking of the NASDAQ, instead of thinking of the sports scores, instead of thinking of the idiot sitting next to me, and instead of thinking of all that, I'm actually reading it and focusing on it and involved in it. It's an amazing experience. It's a flow activity. And it can be an inspiring experience, a pleasurable experience, an experience which, by the way, it gives you a greater sense of control over life. The more, because you see, sometimes a person gets depressed from feeling of a lack of control over circumstances. And there is true, a lot of our circumstances, we do not have control over them. However, I always have control over myself. And if I'm able to do an experience like that, then it gives me a greater feeling of control, and that, of course, makes me happier. And my sense of self is enhanced. That is to say, I feel myself more. I feel my individuality more. And the more I feel myself, my individuality, the happier I will be. The Nachmanides tells us that there's actually a mitzvah, one of the commandments of the Torah. We say it every day in the Shema. It says, Ula avdo b'chol levavchem, which means what? Serve God b'chol levavchem with all your heart. Nachmanides says what that means is that every time you do something, every time you do a mitzvah, something simple, lighting candles, Friday afternoon, not a hard thing to do. But when a person does that and they think about bringing light into the world, and they think about bringing life into the world, and they think about the sanctity of Shabbat, and they think about the family, and you are involved in that activity, and it's not just something done as a haphazard thing, it's done b'chol levavchem, with your entire heart, it becomes a totally different activity. It can be a transformative experience. Person gives charity. Person has a conversation. Anything can be transformed into a flow activity. Number six, whatever. Acting happy. It is interesting to note, Ethics of the Fathers, in Ethics of the Fathers, Shammai says the following. He says this, Hevi mekabel et kol adam, you should accept, greet every single human, besever panim yafot, with a pleasant demeanor. When you meet someone, anyone, smile. What if you don't mean it? What if I don't feel happy about seeing them? Doesn't matter, smile anyway. You know what? There's actually a theory, and actually it seems to be confirmed, that there's something called a feedback mechanism. That when the brain, not when the face is smiling, it actually, the brain says, oh, I should be happy. Smiling actually helps you to become happier. And obviously, by the way, if you go to someone and you smile at them, is it going to make the interaction a better interaction or worse? Well, obviously better, right? You go to the booking agent, right, when the flight's been cancelled, right, and every single person who goes to the booking agent looks like they're about to murder her. They look like a serial killer. They look like a, right, like that. And you come up and say, hi, you must be having a terrible time. I mean, this is a strategy for getting a seat. You know, it's a good idea. But I mean, forget that. Obviously, interactions are going to be better. Just smile at someone. A smile. It says in the Talmud, it says, Halaven Shinai Michalav. It says, one who whitens their teeth to the other person is greater than one who gives the person milk. Whitening the teeth, meaning when you smile at someone, it may be even a greater kindness than giving them food. In fact, Maimonides says, let's say you don't have money. Someone needs charity. You don't have money. What can I do? I don't have change. I don't have money on me, etc., etc. What happens? He says, smile at them. Give them words of encouragement. Of course, it will be good for them. But you know what? For yourself, it will make a big difference. You will be a happier person. If you hug someone, makes you happier. Makes you happier. So acting happy, outward manifestations of happiness, is what we call facial feedback. It enhances our connections, it enhances our relationships, and it enhances our happiness. Another one, very important, is comparison. Stop comparing yourself to other people. Very bad for happiness. Don't compare yourself to others. Right? And what you should try to do is maybe have a little card that says stop. Whenever you start ruminating too much, whenever you start thinking about the other person too much, right, say to yourself, no, stop. Because you see, of course what's going to happen, you're always going to look at other people and see they have some advantage over you. Right? You don't know that you don't know everything that's happening with that person, but we look at that and of course it makes us less happy. It leads to pessimism, a negative self-image. It also, by the way, pessimism leads to, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it interferes in relationships, so many aspects of it. If a person is able to focus not on other people, but focus on yourself, don't compare yourself. And unfortunately, in our culture, we're always comparing ourselves. A part of the Western world, part of the school system, right? What grade did you, if you, one of the terrible things to say to a child, you do not tell a child, you know, how they did compared to the other people. You say, how did you do? Right? In other words, I don't want to be comparing myself to someone else. Comparing myself to myself. Right? There was a great rabbi, Hasidic rabbi called Reb Zusha. And someone said, Rav Zusha, he said, when I get up to heaven, they're not going to ask me, Rav Zusha, why weren't you like Moses? I'll say, Moses, that'd be ridiculous. How can I be like Moses? He says, they won't say to me, Rav Zusha, why weren't you like Maimonides? I'll say, Maimonides, give me a break. Who can I be like Maimonides? They won't say to me, how can you be like the Baal, why weren't you like the Baal Shem Tov? He says, because I'll say, I can't be the Baal Shem Tov. But you know what they'll say to me? Why weren't you Zusha? So really, I have to live up to who I am myself, not comparing myself to others. Comparing myself to others, and I combine with that rumination, that could be why in the Ten Commandments, by the way, the tenth is, don't covet other people. Don't be jealous. Now, it's impossible to avoid, just looking at a car and say, that's a nice car. I'd like that car. That's okay. That's nothing terrible about that. But to ruminate on it, to think about it, to dwell on it, that one has to stop. And when you stop that, guaranteed, you'll be happier. Spirituality, we've got three more, very quickly. Spirituality. When a person is connected to the infinite, a person is connected to the Creator, when a person is connected beyond the mere physical world, when you're connected to something of the infinite, definitely makes you happier. A person who feels that they are connected, there's a loving, caring being who is guiding them, who cares about them, who has given them direction, who has given them purpose, is going to be happier. A person who understands that there's more to life than mere survival is going to be happier. Viktor Frankl pointed out that you can survive any what, providing you know the why. So the more the person's connected to a why, the more the person understands purpose, absolute purpose, goal, right, meaning in life, the greater the meaning in life, the spirituality in life, the greater the happiness of the person. Person who has no feeling of meaning in life, they have no understanding of anything beyond mere physical survival, that person cannot be as happy. Number, whatever we are, I think we're up to number 9, is optimism. Optimism. Optimism also can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you are optimistic, you are more likely to engage in activities that will work. Because if you're pessimistic, you just give up. But if you're optimistic, and optimism, where does optimism come from? First of all, the other activities I mentioned, if you appreciate yourself, what you have, if you have a good self-image, if you're giving to other people, if you have good social relationships, if you are a forgiving person, chances are you'll become more optimistic. Optimism is also created also by a sense of faith in God, a sense of faith in the future. Golda Meir, Prime Minister of Israel, once said, she says, Jews do not have the luxury of being pessimists. Don't have the luxury. We are the most optimistic of peoples. The state of Israel could not have been created if the Jews would be pessimists. You imagine 1945, post-Second World War, displaced persons camp. You know what? Interesting. In 45 to 48, the highest birth rate in any Jewish community in the world was where? In the displaced persons camps in Europe. The Jews, who were survivors of the Holocaust, in those camps, they had optimism. They taught, they got married in the droves, they had children in a higher fertility rate than Jews in the United States, the Jews anywhere in the world. And they taught the children Hebrew, they had classes about Israeli geography, they were learning about agriculture, they had optimism that they would be moving to Israel and they'd be building a country. And that optimism built the country, partially, but certainly had a major impact. If you're not optimistic, you're not going to be able to build anything. You've got to have faith in the future, as Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks puts it. I think that was number 9. Number 10. Maimonides tells us. Number 10 is exercise. Regular exercise. And there's been empirical studies in which they had, I forget the disease, I'm sorry, all these diseases, but they had a group of people, right, that, again, 3 control groups, right, and they've got people, right, who did regular exercise, people who were depressed, actually, people who were depressed. They're people who were on Zoloft, they were actually people who were on antidepressant medication, I remember now, right, they had one group who just took the medication, they had another group who took the medication and exercised regularly, and then another group who only exercised, did not take the medication. Do you know what the results were? The group who exercised and the group who did exercise with Zoloft had exactly the same results. Exercise did as much as the antidepressant medication. As much. And in some cases, more. Why is it so? A, it reduces anxiety and stress. It protects from disease. It increases your quality of life. It improves your sleep. It protects against old age cognitive impairments. It helps control weight. So if that's not enough for you, that's not enough. In addition, you see, if you take a drug and that makes you feel better, and you do exercise and that makes you feel better, why is the exercise a superior form? Because you see, in the case of the drug, it's not you who did it, it's the drug that did it. In the case of exercise, who enacted the improvement? I did it. So I feel in control of myself. I feel good about myself. I take a drug and I feel better. I feel good about the drug company. I don't care about the drug company. Right? They did it. The drug did it. It wasn't me. It's something else controlling me, right? Just like the depression was controlling me, the Zoloft is controlling me. But in the exercise, I'm in control. Unbelievable. It improves your self-esteem because you're making progress. You're making progress. You're feeling better. It takes time out from stress. It improved physical abilities, increased happiness. You know, if I can pick up something without, oh my gosh, then of course I'm going to be happier. My father always says, he's 86 old Gesundheit, he says, it's amazing, he says. He was picking up something, he says, what? Why do they make the floor so much lower today than they used to? But obviously, if you're able to, the greater your physical abilities, of course the happier you'll be. And elevates the serotonin level, obviously, but and most importantly, and also, it's just the very general feeling of exercise actually makes you happy when you exercise at the time of the exercise, and it can obviously transform into your life. So those are 10 things that anyone can do. 10 things anyone can do. I don't expect, and I don't do all 10. We try. But you know what? You try to choose one or two of these things, three of these things, four of these things, and do it regularly. But the most important thing is start now. Start immediately. Forgiveness, giving, love, smiling, hugging, letting people merge, right? Exercise, all of these things, flow experiences, increased spirituality, focusing on what you're doing, appreciation, blessing God, thank you, thank God for this, etc. All of these things will, the Torah tells us, they'll make us happier. The sages tell us they'll make us happier. Empirical research tells us they'll make us happier. So what is there to lose? That's it for this evening. Thank you very much for listening and hope you enjoy it. Is there a question time or... No, I don't know. Who's questions, heckling, alternate speeches? Yeah.
Do you think there's so much unhappiness in America because... such a selfish society?
First of all, it's not just America. So I'm Australian. It's not just America, but I think part of it is that we have a sense of entitlement. It may be in America, people have a sense of entitlement that I deserve, right? In a society focused on rights, it's interesting, there was a legal scholar called Susan Last Stone. She teaches at Harvard. She does comparative legal studies between Judaism and secular law. One of the things she points out is that a system where the emphasis in the legal emphasis on rights becomes a very self-centered system. Because rights means I'm thinking about what do you owe me? What do I deserve? What is my rights? And therefore that creates, she says, or enhances a self-centeredness, as you pointed out, and a sense of entitlement, and that of course is going to make me less happy. In a system, she says, Jewish law focuses on, not rights, but on obligation. That's what can I do, not what can I get. Had we followed John F. Kennedy's advice in the United States, who said in his inaugural speech, ask not what your nation can do for you, ask what you can do for your nation. But to paraphrase him, ask not what others can do for you, ask what you can do for others. That's a happier relationship. In a marriage, if each one is saying, what can I do for him, what can I do for her, as opposed to what can she do for me, what can she do for me, is that happy? That's not going to be happy. Right? So it's a self-centeredness, certainly. And also I think so. And the abundance of choices makes us less appreciative of what we have. Right, so I remember the first time I came to the States. I think I was 17. So the time, so I came to a store to get a drink. I said, can I have a Coke, please? And she says, we don't have Coke, we have Pepsi. I said, fine, okay, I'll have a Pepsi. She says, you want 12 ounce, you want 4 ounce, you want this ounce? I said, Australia is like small, large, medium, whatever. I said, I don't know, 12 ounce. You want ice, crushed ice, no ice? It was unbelievable. Yeah, and it's in New York, and behind me people are saying, can you hurry up there? What's going on? You know, it's like unbelievable. Right, so sometimes you have so many choices, right, that you don't appreciate anything, right? So that's a bit of a problem. It's a bit of a problem, yeah. But the self, and also I would say the materialism and the embedded in that means that we're a little more disconnected from spirituality, right? And also, which also has an impact. Yeah. But it's not only America. This is in Europe. People are not happier in Europe. People are not happier in England, right? There are places, it's interesting, I noted that there are certain places I see people happier. I was in South Africa 2 years ago, in Kruger, did a safari with some, it's an amazing thing that every single African that we met seemed to be like happy, really happy, right? The guys, and they were people who were not making a lot of money, they were people who were not living in great circumstances, but there seemed to be a sense of happiness. I think partially it may have been because there was a sense of now being building their own country, and maybe it was the end of apartheid. I don't know what it was. I don't want to say too much here. I think there are South Africans here, so I don't want to get reconciliation, please. But again, there was certain happiness there. Part of it is that you feel you're building something of your own, as opposed to building something of someone else. That also creates some happiness, right? So, like, you know, being a cog in the wheel of some corporation, etc., right? Or if the country you're building is your own country, tremendous happiness there as well. Yeah. Okay, if there's no other questions, thank you very much for coming, and I hope we'll see you around.